It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. At last weekend's state Democratic convention, delegates voted to pass a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the Israel-Hamas war.
The resolution passed 135-91 with just over 200 delegates voting, but more than 600 delegates were present at the event.
Pro-Palestinian protesters also interrupted a speech by Senator Tammy Baldwin, highlighting tensions within the state's Democratic Party over the ongoing conflict in the Middle East.
Now we're going to hear from two delegates with different perspectives on this weekend's votes.
Hiba Mohammed is a Democratic activist and organizer for Listen to Wisconsin. She was one of the delegates who voted in favor of the ceasefire resolution at the state convention this weekend. Hiba, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
What specifically was in this ceasefire resolution that delegates passed at the state Democratic convention?
Yeah, thank you. So within the ceasefire resolution, which was passed in both the 4th Congressional District and the 1st before it made it to the state convention, was facts on the ground, right? So we named the scale of atrocities that Palestinians are facing, named it for the genocide that it is. And the biggest part here was the final clause, right? The resolved clause, which calls for an immediate unconditional ceasefire, an overwhelmingly popular position within the Democratic Party this weekend. And among Democratic voters in Wisconsin. So I'm very proud and pleased to see that the party members stood with this opinion and are hoping to hold Joe Biden and his administration accountable to the values that they purport to hold when it comes to justice and human rights.
Why was it important to you that Wisconsin Democrats in particular passed this resolution?
Mm-hmm. Well, we know the path to the White House runs through Wisconsin. Back in April, 48,000 Democratic Party voters voted uninstructed to send a clear message to Joe Biden that we demand a ceasefire, an end to the siege on Gaza, an end to U.S. military aid, and restoration of humanitarian aid to support Palestinians in their recovery. And this was a reminder to him that those voters want to see better, those voters which make up twice his margin of victory in 2020. And so to have the party's membership vote to affirm those positions was really important to remind Joe Biden that there isn't a winning coalition in November that doesn't include these anti-war, pro-peace voters. And that's the message that was sent this weekend.
The resolution passed among the delegates who voted, but about two-thirds-ish of the delegates at the convention didn't vote. Do you see this as an issue that's really top of mind as Wisconsin Democrats are looking ahead to the presidential election?
Yeah, I do think that it is top of mind for a lot of people here. The turnout for the vote was pretty typical for state conventions based on past experiences and knowledge of past conventions. And I think it's important to note that the folks who are in that room are self-selected party faithful, right? Folks who are going to be doing the grassroots work to elect Democrats up and down the ballot. And they're the ones who sent this message over the weekend. These are people who the party depends on. And if they're seeing this for what it is, if again, voters outside of this, the institution of the Democratic Party, but who vote Democratic, sent that message in April. These are things that cannot be ignored by the administration, by the Democratic Party structure, if they actually want to serve their voters and their party's base.
We're talking to Democratic activist Hiba Mohammed about the state Democratic convention last weekend, delegates passing a solution there calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Hiba, your organization, Listen to Wisconsin, campaigned for Democrats to vote uninstructed in the presidential primary instead of voting for Joe Biden or an alternative candidate. What did you see that accomplishing?
Yeah, so we want a policy change immediately. And that is why we chose to use the uninstructed primary effort as a way to send that message. There are a number of other efforts going on, which I think are important as well to demand accountability. But the point of our uninstructed effort was to say we need policy change now. We are using the leverage of this primary to send that clear message to him. And we did. We had those four demands clear as day. And our voters, 48,000 of them, said that unless there is a serious policy change on Gaza that includes an unconditional ceasefire, an end to U.S. military aid, and to the siege and restoration of aid, that we will not be voting for Joe Biden. And importantly, many of those voters said if there is a policy change, they will consider voting for Joe Biden come November. So we've given him a roadmap to make the policy changes in order to win. And now the ball is in his court, and we hope that he will listen to the repeated messages that we're sending.
You were just hinting at this. What would be at least a minimum from the Biden administration for that policy change that you think might convince people in your camp to rethink this?
For us, it's meeting all four of those demands. I know within this broader coalition of folks who supported Uninstructed and who support an end to this genocide, an immediate unconditional ceasefire is first and foremost. It is the bare minimum that is required right now. But we also understand that a ceasefire is not going to resolve the greater issue here that is continuing to kill Palestinians, which is the ongoing occupation, and this Zionist entity that is a settler colonial entity.
There were concerns. There was another resolution condemning anti-Semitism, a line specifically condemning the Hamas attacks last October, I believe, was removed before the final version of that. Would you want to see, is it okay, do you think, to include language condemning the Hamas attack in October that killed over 1,000 people?
Yeah, nothing precluded anyone from introducing a resolution that condemned Hamas. That was not the intention behind ours. Ours calls for an end to the violence on all sides and appropriately names the scale of genocide Palestinians are facing. The resolution you're referencing, it was actually not a reference to the Hamas attack. It was a reference to a rise in anti-Semitic incidents since October 7th. And the reason it was removed is that percentage uses the Anti-Defamation League's definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates anti-Zionism and criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, which we've heard from Jewish folks around the world, really, that that conflation is dangerous and does nothing to protect the Jewish community from true acts of anti-Semitism. So that is why that line was removed. And I'm, again, glad that the party membership saw that for what it was, which was a way to chill free speech around Palestinian activism.
And Hiba, some of your fellow Democrats might say, hey, wait a minute, if you're not going to vote for President Biden, that might lead to a second Trump administration. Do you think that would accomplish your policy goals any better than a second Biden administration?
I think for folks who are concerned about Donald Trump winning because there aren't enough anti-war, pro-peace voters voting for Biden, need to take that to President Biden and to remind him that, again, the ball is in his court. We've given him a roadmap with our four basic demands through the Uninstructed campaign. And if they're afraid of Trump winning, Biden is the one who needs to earn our votes back. It shouldn't be the other way around where we as voters feel like we have to save this tortured democracy. Our elected officials and our candidates need to be the ones who are doing the right thing in order to earn our votes. So I encourage them to continue pressuring the Biden administration.
Hiba, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hiba Mohammed is a Democratic activist organizer for Listen to Wisconsin. Now we'll hear from Democratic State Representative Lisa Subek of Madison, who's pushing for the party to support President Biden and his efforts in the Middle East. Representative Subek, welcome to Wisconsin today.
Thank you for having me.
Representative Subek, what was your reaction to this ceasefire resolution passed at the convention last weekend?
Sure. So unfortunately, there was not enough time to get through all of the resolutions at the meeting. I think that what was passed, unfortunately, came ahead of a resolution that would have called for adoption of the Biden peace plan, which includes a ceasefire, returning hostages, delivery of humanitarian aid, and really the opportunity for a last. And I think that most Democrats are really supportive of a lasting peace in the Middle East. We want to see a two-state solution. I think what we heard from your previous guest is a little bit different. And certainly she's part of an organized group that brought a number of people to the convention and made sure they were in the room for the resolution vote, also sort of took up a good chunk of time. That meant we couldn't get to a resolution brought forth by the Jewish caucus that really was a resolution in support of the Biden peace plan and where we were hearing folks were at. So, you know, I think at the end of the day, Wisconsinites all want, and Democrats stand pretty strongly for peace in the Middle East. We recognize the need for a two-state solution that recognizes the right to sovereignty for both for both Israel and Palestine. But at the same time, we recognize that we've got to get rid of Hamas. Hamas is an organized, recognized terrorist group. And as long as we have calls for an unconditional ceasefire, that only sets Hamas up to be able to continue to rebuild and continue to attack Israel. What most Democrats support is a lasting peace, and that means the return of the hostages, and it means being able to come to a conclusion with the two-state solution.
Representative Subek, of course, Wisconsin has very close statewide elections. Calls from some people saying, hey, we usually might vote Democratic because of Middle East policy. We might not or maybe will not, as we were just hearing there from Hiba Muhammad. What would you say to those voters?
Sure. So again, I would say that, you know, there's a lot of nuance here, and that's a pretty small group that is sort of on the edge or on the extremes on this issue. That said, I'm not sure that a Trump presidency is any better for them. I also would remind folks, though, that as long as, you know, Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and it is the Jewish state, and as long as Hamas is allowed to remain in power, that Jewish state is threatened. And, you know, most people don't want that. You know, the idea of terrorists running the show is really horrifying. What happened on October 7th was awful. And we will see more October 7th as long as Hamas is able to remain in power. So we want a quick and rapid end to what's happening in the Middle East. We want a lasting and enduring peace, though, not an end that allows it to simply keep flaring up again as it has over a period.
In just our last couple of moments, Representative Subek, we're focusing on one moment here at the Democratic state primary. Was the Middle East issue, you think, top of mind for most Democratic activists at the convention?
I don't think so. I mean, I was hearing about issues like threats to abortion, threats to access to health care, about issues at the core of our democracy. Those were the things that most people were talking about. At the end of the day, there was incredible support for President Biden, for Democrats up and down the ticket. And frankly, most people at the convention, my impression was, felt that Biden is on the right track and that he is the president that will lead us forward to a lasting peace in the Middle East, but he is also the president who will ensure that we have access to abortion and access to contraception. He is the president who will make sure our democracy stays intact.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Representative Lisa Subek. We also heard from Democratic activist Hiba Muhammad.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a Madison clinic provides free walk-in care for people with opioid use disorder.
This is a really complex societal problem, and we have to look a little bit upstream and think really broadly about what are all the factors that have gotten us to where we are.
New ways to help people who use substances, that's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For the first time in 5 years, overdose deaths involving opioids declined slightly in our country in 2023. That's according to newly released preliminary data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And Wisconsin is among the states showing a decrease in opioid deaths compared to the previous year.
A new walk-in clinic in Madison is on the front lines of the addiction crisis. It's for people seeking treatment for substance use disorder, regardless of their ability to pay. The clinic offers prescription medications for opioid use disorder, basic wound care, and hepatitis testing.
Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar is medical director of this clinic called Compass. She is an associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine and Community Health at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've talked with the Department of Health Services, and they're saying that there are no other clinics like Compass in Dane County. What sets this clinic apart?
There are a couple of things that I think make us really unique. The first is that we very much developed the clinic to make sure that we would be able to take folks who are walking in. So you don't need an appointment to come to our clinic. It's set up predominantly as a walk-in clinic, and we will see, you know, anyone who comes in that day. And usually pretty quickly, it's first come, first serve. So if three people walk in all at the same time, of course, we have to sort of see folks in the order that they come. But we've had really good experiences with being able to see people right away. And then the second thing is that in addition to providing medications for addiction treatment, and that's really our focus is on supporting people who use substances, and particularly with opioid use disorder, but we're happy to see folks with other substance use disorders as well. So in addition to providing those addiction treatment services, we also provide some other medical services that we know a lot of folks who use substances can have trouble accessing. And that's sort of the second piece that makes us really unique. So we can see individuals who might have wound care needs. So maybe they have some wounds associated with injection drug use. We can do that in our clinic. We can treat hepatitis C. Lots of folks who inject drugs or many folks who inject drugs can acquire hepatitis C. And so our clinic offers, you know, really immediate access to hepatitis C treatment, which not only helps the individual, but helps protect others in the community from getting hepatitis C. We're able to offer some vaccinations in our clinic. We offer STI testing and treatment. And also for folks who can become pregnant but don't want to be, we can offer some basic contraceptive services. So really the immediate access walk-in model, I should have mentioned, we can also see individuals who don't have any insurance. So we can really see anyone is probably the one of the unique elements. And then the second unique element is all of the additional services that we're able to offer.
And just crossing your threshold, that is a huge step in itself. And I just wonder, what might someone say when they walk in the door of Compass?
Yeah, so and that's a great point, because I should also acknowledge we are sort of co-located in a bigger clinic called Behavioral Health and Recovery, or BHR. And so if someone were to walk in the door, they would just say, you know, there's a very standard medical sort of clinic setting, and they would just say, I'm here for Compass program, or, you know, I'm here for medications for addiction or whatever it might be. And that really starts the registration process. And usually our nurse comes out right away to greet people, sort of figure out what they're looking for, make sure we can offer it. And if by chance they're looking for something that we can't offer, we'll help them figure out where they should go and what the next steps might be. And so our front desk staff are really lovely. We couldn't do our work without them. And they'll really help people kind of figure out, you know, what it is they're looking for, and make sure that Maddie, who's our nurse, or whoever, you know, if she has someone filling in for her that day, comes out and checks in with people really quickly, just to make sure, again, that they feel welcome and that we're getting them where they need to be.
Okay, so initial assessments here. The clinic opened around 4 months ago. What has demand been like?
Yeah, and so it's a good question. You know, the first few weeks it was pretty slow, and I think it takes a little while to both get the word out on the street, so to speak. It also takes a little while for people to build trust in the community. And so we've been really fortunate. We have a lot of community partners, and our numbers have been steadily increasing over the last few months. I should mention we're only open right now on Tuesdays and Fridays. We're a grant-funded program, and that's sort of what we were able to start with. And so just in those first few months, we've seen somewhere between 30 and 50 individual patients those 2 days a week, and we've had over 100 visits. And so we are seeing numbers pretty steadily increasing, and we expect that as we continue to build trust and people feel safe coming in and talking to us, meeting with us, those numbers will continue to grow.
Have you had to turn anyone away?
We have not. I mean, there have been one or two people who have come in and asked for a service that we don't offer. So, for example, someone was looking for specifically chronic pain treatment and wanted some very specific interventions that, you know, we're not a pain clinic. So we couldn't offer that, but we are happy to sort of sit down with you and figure out where you can go for that. And then someone else came in and was really specifically looking for peer recovery services, which is a service we offer, but you don't have to get it through our clinic. And so our peer support specialist on our team sat down with that individual and said, yeah, let me talk to you about where you can go for that, and really like got them signed up for those services. And so although they didn't need any of the medical services we were offering. So again, we kind of think of ourselves as a safety net. So, you know, we'll offer everything that we can. And if there's something that someone needs that we can't offer, our goal is really to help them figure out where they can go.
It sounds like you're also able to connect with other safety net services, other social services that really could help, you know, make their recovery journey more stable.
100%. And I think the reality is that most people who are struggling with substance use or sort of sequelae of substance use disorder, you know, the medical piece is an important piece, but definitely not the only one, and often not even the most important piece. And so, you know, I'll give a shout out to our peer support specialist on our team. His name is Wes. He just does a tremendous job of helping people link up with all kinds of community services, from housing to recovery residents, figuring out residential when people want that, but also thinking about vocational training and just, I mean, he's really wonderful. And I think those are some of the services that, you know, honestly really can kind of make it or break it for people who are interested in recovery and figuring out sort of what are all the pieces that are going to need to pull together for someone to really achieve their goals.
Madison Emergency Medical Services, they recently started carrying buprenorphine, the prescription medication that treats acute opioid withdrawal. And Compass, in part, opened as a response to this initiative. Can you explain that connection there?
Sure. And so, you know, it was both EMS and the local emergency rooms. And so, you know, really at this point, we know that medications for opioid use disorder, and buprenorphine is the one that is able to be provided, you know, by EMS and in the ER. We know that that medicine saves lives. But really, if people get started on the medicine, they need a way to be able to continue it. And so if you imagine, you know, being in the ER at 2 a.m. or an ambulance call to respond to an overdose at 2 a.m., there's really no way that they're going to be able to figure out, okay, well, what insurance do you have and which program can you go to? And even if they were able to do all that, to then call the program and make an appointment is just not going to happen, right, in the middle of the night. And so they were really willing and happy to offer this service, but then where people could go became a huge challenge, right? So we can start you on the medicine, even in the field now, in the case of EMS, but then it was hard to know where to tell people to go, because really there are so many insurance limitations, and, you know, EMS can't keep track of what the wait lists are at every single program, et cetera. And so this makes it a really easy way for them to have confidence that if they meet someone who has started on buprenorphine, they can say, look, you just show up at this clinic on Tuesday or Friday, and the team there will see you. They'll make sure they get you more medicine, and they'll be able to support your other medical needs. Really gave them sort of the piece that they needed to be able to do the work that they wanted to do. Because just to give someone a dose of medicine once, but without any follow-up plan, isn't going to be likely to help someone very much. But to be able to give the medicine and have confidence they have a place to follow up is, you know, sort of the system of care, largely speaking, that we're all aiming for.
Yeah, making those connection points so important. The clinic is young, but are there only so many number of chances? Like, if someone tries and fails with medicine assisted treatment, can they come back and try again?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We don't even really think about someone, the door is always open. I don't know how else to say it. Mm-hmm. You know, and for some folks, you know, there are just lots of life circumstances that can get in the way. And so they might come and try medicine for a week or a couple weeks, and then something happens, they're not able to make it in, or they, you know, just aren't continuing medication for whatever reason. The door is always open. And for a lot of people, things don't work the first time. And I often, you know, think about it like a diet or an exercise plan. Many of us have like set out like, okay, you know, today's the day, I'm going to start exercising every single day for this many minutes. And, you know, we all have bad days. And I think substance use is a behavior change that's not so different. Like, there's sometimes when folks really feel like, okay, right now is the moment. And then sometimes it goes really well. And sometimes there are rough patches. But for us, we are really happy to see people anytime, you know, they're sort of looking to make a change. And sometimes the change, you know, I mentioned wound care, pretty much everybody who's come in so far has been there looking for medication treatments. But we are also really happy to see folks who come in and say, look, you know, I have this wound. I don't know if I'm ready to stop using drugs right now, but I really want to get medical treatment so it doesn't get worse. We're happy to see those folks as well. We really view any opportunity for engagement as a positive one. And if people are interested in improving their health, whatever that looks like for them, we're super happy to see them.
We're talking about this new clinic in Dane County serving people with opioid use disorder, free walk-in services. We have UW Health Addiction Medicine physician Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar, who is medical director at Compass. Dr. Salisbury Afshar, in terms of other referrals, Dane County Jail referring patients to Compass, what is the experience like for people who are exiting incarceration and have a substance use disorder?
Sure. So, so far, I think that most of the referrals we've gotten from the jail have been specifically for the Vivitrol program. So Vivitrol is an injectable medicine that's extended release naltrexone. That's the generic name. So it's an injection that someone gets once a month. And locally, the Dane County Jail does have a program where they offer this medicine, usually fairly close to the point of release. And so we've had some folks come in and say, you know, I want to continue this injection. Can I get it here? And the answer is absolutely yes. We do stock the medicine. And so our goal is that if someone's leaving incarceration and they're looking for any form of medication treatment, we are so happy to see them. And we can, again, sort of we're able and on the day that they show up to give that repeat injection if they're due. If they're not due, then we'll bring them back at about that 4-week mark. We also are offering hepatitis C treatment. And so making sure that folks are aware that if they've been given a diagnosis of hepatitis C, that's something else that we can initiate in our program.
There are these peer support specialists at the clinic. How are they helping to support patients who walk in and making sure that their needs are going to be met and they're in the right place?
So our peer support specialist or recovery coach, they go by sort of different titles. Mm-hmm. We have one peer in clinic every day that we're open, and they are one of the first individuals that meet with patients on their first visit. And they're working with our nurse to figure out, okay, what are your needs? You know, do you have safe housing? Do you have transportation needs? Do you have food insecurity, right? What are all the possible resources we might be able to help you link up with? So that's one of the first things they're doing. And then they're also saying, you know, hey, would it be helpful if I give you a phone call in between visits? Or would it be okay if I stop in next time you're here and just check in on how things are going? And so they're both helping with linking with community resources that might be very specific to recovery, but might just be more general related to sort of general needs for survival and living. And so they do all of that work in addition to really being someone to listen and understanding what it's like to go through, you know, some of the hard experiences that people struggling with addiction often have faced, and kind of just being that peer, someone to listen, someone to talk to. So they play a really critical role on our team.
Stepping back from the clinic for a moment and looking overall at how to tackle this addiction crisis, and we saw these new figures from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention signaling that drug overdose deaths related to opioids fell slightly in 2023. This is the first time in 5 years, still preliminary data there, but what will it take to continue this decline?
It's a great question. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, there was a decline, or at least we think a small decline, but the numbers are still just way too high, right? These are preventable deaths. And I wish, I really believe, right, if there was a single thing that we could do to make this go away, I would like to believe we would have done it. But I think the reality is this is a really complex societal problem. And we have to look a little bit upstream and think really broadly about what are all the factors that have gotten us to where we are. And so I think, you know, I think it's housing. I think it's educational opportunities. I think it's living wage jobs. I think it's treatment access, and not just substance use disorder treatment, but mental health treatment. I think it's figuring out ways to interrupt cycles of trauma and poverty, because all of these factors are contributing, as is the really unstable drug supply. In particular, you know, every time I feel like I open my computer or read the news, there's sort of a new novel substance being cut into the drug supply. And so people who are using substances don't know often what they're getting, which increases the risk. And so it's sort of this, you know, really complex interplay of all of these factors. And so what I really think it's going to take is all of these different sectors continuing to work together. And I don't mean to imply that we're not already, but there's a lot more work to be done. And when you work with folks who use substances, you know, we really need to include them at the table when we're talking about solutions, because they're the ones having these experiences. And so, you know, definitely reducing stigma, definitely moving away from really punitive models that have historically focused on incarcerating people. We know that incarceration is not a treatment for addiction, right? We have evidence-based services for addiction, and incarceration is not one of them. Continuing to expand access to naloxone. So again, so many pieces to this puzzle, and really it's going to take all of us working together in a really thoughtful way to make sure that we continue to move things in the direction that we want to see them, which is, of course, less death and improved wellness in our community at large.
Dr. Salisbury Afshar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks again so much for having me.
Dr. Elizabeth Salisbury Afshar is medical director of Compass in Madison. It's a new walk-in clinic for people with substance use disorder. Recovery from addiction is possible. For help, call the free and confidential treatment referral hotline. That number is 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP, or visit findtreatment.gov.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today, and when you're looking for the top news from around the state, check out WPR's podcast called Wisconsin Today Morning News. It's available now. Subscribe and listen wherever you get your podcasts or at WPR.org. Just ahead on Wisconsin Today, a children's author in Green Bay has a new book to inspire Black youth and dare kids to dream big.
And maybe some of our government leaders can grab a copy and just read some of the pages in the book, because it's a book about hope.
That's next here on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about home.
Home means different things to all of us. Home can be the house you grew up in, a quiet spot in the woods, or right beside your favorite person. For Milo Lee of Appleton, defining her home is complicated. She shares her story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
Home is a hard concept for me. I was born in a refugee camp. I was in the Bang Vi Nai Holding Center in northeastern Thailand. So home to me has never been a physical placement. Home has never been an address or location. The awareness of what home is has always been associated with a feeling of safety. There are a few things that remind me of home. The first is the smell of traditional Hmong black chicken boiled with mong chua. This herb bundle includes lemongrass, joe pie weed, Okinawa spinach, and mugwort, among the many other Hmong traditional herbs. As a young child, this earthy smell greeted me many early mornings and comforted me many late evenings. My immigrant Hmong parents had taken refuge from the American War in Vietnam and eventually made central Wisconsin their new home. One of their chosen professions was ginseng farming. Therefore, I was a ginseng farmer. During the early summer mornings, I would be greeted with the smell of boiled chicken and herbs for breakfast, because according to my parents, farming is real work and I needed real food. My family's WIC-approved cereal was only good for learning at school. At the age of 7, I was manually removing large rocks from untilled acres of farmland in preparation of the land being tractor-tilled for ginseng crops. Once the ginseng plants were seeded and emerged from their hay beds, I worked every day. I would pull wild violets, goosegrass, creeping charlie, and crabgrass weeds underneath the aluminum mesh net that created shade for the ginseng plants. After a long day of farming, most evenings my mom would add more water, salt, and black pepper and reheat the boiled chicken for dinner. I always felt safe eating this dish. I felt safe adding more black pepper or asking for red chilies to spice up my dish. Still, one of my favorite dishes is home-cooked white jasmine rice with hot black chicken boiled with chua. There's another thing that makes me feel instantly at home, and that's when I hear Wisconsin Public Radio. The early dark morning rides to the ginseng fields were often long. I always liked listening because I never feared having to speak back. As a dual language child who had a stammer and stutter, conversations scared me. Conversations scared me because I was unsure of how much of myself I would share, if my words would come out right if I did want to share, and lastly, would I matter? Wisconsin Public Radio allowed me to be safe, to be part of the conversation by listening and learning. As Hmong refugees, my mom and dad often listened to WPR because of the weekly Hmong public radio. Every radio in the house, ginseng field and car, was defaulted to Wisconsin Public Radio in fear of missing the Saturday Hmong program. The Hmong program was special to me because I was able to hear Hmong conversations by Hmong people. This was something I did not see on television or at school. Home is a hard concept for me. It may be because I was born in a refugee camp. It may be because I was raised in central Wisconsin, growing up along the sides of shaded ginseng crops. Home to me has never been a physical placement. Home has never been a physical address or location. Home is where I am safe.
Milo Lee of Appleton is a cultural and engagement strategist with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Her story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
A Wisconsin author is sharing the message that anything and everything is possible in a new children's book. It's called Dear You, Dream Big.
Through pictures and words, author Baptiste Paul of Green Bay speaks directly to Black and brown children about racial inequality and emotions that children of color may experience. Baptiste, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you, Kit, for having me. I am just super excited to be here. Yeah, it's a dream of mine to be on, you know, on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, I love to hear that. Well, thank you so much. And, you know, writing about the harmful effects of racism and discrimination is really complicated. What compels you to talk directly to children of color in your new book about these racial inequalities?
Kit, for me, it's all about hope, right? If hope is lost, everything is lost. That's one of the themes in the book, you know, I'm talking about. And I think because, like, I want every Black and brown child to know that although history has been purposefully written to disadvantage them, that they control their own destiny. All they need to do is to find someone who looks like them in a space that they want to explore. And just latch on to that individual and just go for it. Because, kid, I remember, like, when I was a kid growing up, I had a teacher who once called me dumb and stupid. And those wounds are still fresh, and it still hurt to this day. Mm. But my champion was my mom. She was a rock star. And she told me I am smart, I am intelligent, and I should never give up. And I've latched on to those words ever since.
Was it difficult to believe in those words, even someone like your mother, who really stood beside you? I mean, how do children of color experience racism and process discrimination differently than adults do?
As a child, you really don't know how to process some of those like deep emotions and those deep feelings. And you question everything about yourself and everything about like who you are. And I know some children are going through some really tough time, tough times right now and tough situations right now. But my hope is that at least they can find someone at home, at school, a teacher, a friend, just someone they can talk to. Because by talking to someone, it goes a long way, a really long way.
Your mom believed in the value of education. Do you have a story to share or what she instilled in you?
So as the story about my mom, grew up as an indentured servant on the island of St. Lucia in the Caribbean. And she was not allowed to go to school. So basically she worked at the more affluent people's homes. So the story she told me was one day she left. She just abandoned the job where she was cleaning and she saw the kids going to school. So she followed the kids, the wealthy family's kids, to school. And she walked into a classroom and in a building and she sat down for the first time in a classroom. And she told me this was the best 2 minutes of her life ever. But within a minute or so, her mom came and her mom spanked her and brought her all the way back to the job where she was at. But she told me those 2 minutes was the most liberating thing ever. And I just want the audience to know that my mom is still illiterate. My mom can't read and my mom can't write. But she made a promise after that day that every single one of her children was going to get an education, no matter what.
Oh, that's such a powerful story. You grew up in St. Lucia, this island country in the Caribbean. Were books accessible to you as a child?
Oh, I have lots of stories for you. At school, no. But as a child, I used to walk a 12-mile journey round trip to the only library on the southern side of the island for books to read. Most days, kid, I walked barefoot down the road, and it was like blacktop roads, and then I had to cross a river. Just imagine a 10-year-old, right, going down to the library. But the most interesting thing about it, it was back in the day when the airport, like climbing the fence or scaling the airport fence, and crossing the runway was a little bit more laxed. Uh-huh. So that's what I did. I climbed the fence. I run across the runway, but I checked the skies to see if a plane was coming first. And then I run across the runway. And then I got into town, went to the library, and I grabbed my books to read. And I repeated the process again. And it was a 12-mile journey. And I did it 2 to 3 times a week. Because as a child, I just wanted an adventure. I just wanted an escape, and I wanted to go places like my island could not provide. And I found those comforts in the pages of books. And that was just liberating to me.
This also feels like it's a world away from Green Bay, where you are situated now as a children's author. How do these experiences from your childhood inform what you put on the pages for your books?
One of the things that I do is I travel a lot and I present all around the state, all around the country and internationally as well. And part of the message I teach is about empathy and want kids to be able to connect and relate to other people's experiences. So even though it's like a world away from Green Bay, there are so many similarities in what I did as a child and what kids in Green Bay do. And some of the experiences involves like play, like kids just love to play, right? Mm. No matter what it is. And I remember like growing up, we played in the rain, in the dirt, in the mud. And that was my first book called The Field. Just going back a little bit then, but I did a Skype visit with a school in St. Lucia, kid. And one child said to me in the end of the presentation, he was crying. And I thought I said something wrong. Or I did something wrong. And he said, no. He said, this is the first time in my life I have seen my experiences represented on the pages of books. And this is the first time I've seen my language, the Creole words that I speak every day, printed in the pages of a book. And then he said the most important thing ever. He said, when I grow up, I want to be an author like you. Mm. That just gave me so much hope. And that's part of my message. Like when I travel the state, that's the message I want to bring to students all around the country. Hey, I came from a really small town, a really small place in St. Lucia. And I am all the way in Wisconsin right now. And think about St. Lucia, like you said earlier, it's like worlds away from Green Bay. And there are still small towns where kids, maybe some of the schools in those small towns have never had access to an author. And that's the kind of message I want to bring to those kids and to those schools around the country, that all you have to do is dream big and be exposed to people who are in those fields and just go for it.
Just go for it. Talking about a new children's book, it's called Dear You, Dream Big, and it is by children's author Baptiste Paul of Green Bay. Baptiste, in the book, it has a really powerful beginning. On the first page, there's a young Black boy drawing a picture, and in the background, two children of different races laughing at him. And the line you write says, "Even though there are those who wish to silence you." What should young readers take away from that moment?
Oh, wow, that's a good point. Like, I felt when I wrote this, I was talking to the younger me. Mm. And because I've had people made fun of me and ridiculed me. And to every Black and brown child in the world, I thought at that moment I needed to tell them, like, hey, I have been there. I know what it feels. It's so uncomfortable. But I persevered and I moved on and I became better. And it's just a moment, right? A small moment in life. And we should not let small moments define the rest of our lives.
You follow several Black children in the book who each want to become an artist, a scientist, president. Why did you choose these specific scenarios to inspire your young readers?
Tony D. Chambers actually did that, to choose like three different career paths to show like Black and brown children that, hey, you can do any of it and all of it. So I've been lucky enough throughout the years to have had a really close relationship with illustrators when I work.
Baptiste Paul, your passion to educate children includes visits to classrooms. You mentioned visiting a classroom remotely as well in your homeland. Do you talk with children about their aspirations? And what do you learn after these visits?
Oh, I'm always learning a lot from those visits. I'm always learning. And I do talk to the kids about their aspirations. And one thing that I always do also is, when I'm done with every single presentation, and if time runs out, I allow the students through the teachers to email me the questions so I can answer them directly. Because when sometimes a child doesn't feel comfortable to talk about their aspirations directly to an author because they're shy, right? Mm. And not all of us are bold. And I will allow and create a space where it's safe and comfortable for that child to write to me, where I can answer those questions for every single child. And over the years, I've received tons of amazing letters from students all around the world.
I love that. Baptiste, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for sharing your work.
Oh, thank you so much, Kit, for having me.
Baptiste Paul is a children's author who lives in Green Bay.
Now, marijuana is illegal in Wisconsin, but it might be confusing because a lot of stores have signs advertising variant products that for technical reasons aren't banned by law.
And some Republican members of the state legislature say they want to change the law to ban those products as well.
We're going to dig into those products and the laws surrounding them on a future show, and we want to hear from you now. Are you confused about what is and isn't legal? What do you want in state law? Crackdown on these alternative products or legalization of medical or recreational marijuana?
Call or text us. Reach out to us at 888-642-0232. You can also email at wisconsintoday@wpr.org and share your thoughts and questions. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.